Hello, and welcome to the Game Audio Hour, episode 253. This is a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets. Here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. I'm your host, Alex May, and I'm joined today for episode 253 by Michael Gordon Shapiro. How are you this week, Mike?
I am doing splendidly. It is currently windy outside, which is not a common phenomenon in Los Angeles meteorology. But as I'm a fan of white noise, I rather like it when nature provides some. And how about yourself? How are you doing? You're coming back from quite an adventure with many musical components, no?
Yeah, that's correct. It's been actually a proverbial hot minute, as they say, since our last recording. And a fair bit has happened in the game audio world. We've had Black Friday, Cyber Monday just past week, and something else much more significant has also happened to our compatriot Vince, who is now a proud father. So let's have a quick, silent, not too peaky round of applause for Vince there. Congratulations, Vince, if you're listening. And Vince will be back on the show in when the time is right. So he's on a paternal leave right now. And all the best for this wonderful new transition into the new phase, a new era of life for Vince. But yes, so I have actually been on quite a number of adventures in the past, what's it been, I guess, month that we've been off air, I guess. Would it be about a month? I think that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. The most notable of which I have to tell you about. Absolutely incredible. I went with my father and my two children to Vienna. That's Vienna in Austria, in case you were wondering, which is a bit of a step south from Sweden, where I am currently located. And my father, of course, being a very avid consumer of classical music of all varieties, he bought us some excellent tickets while we were there to hear an opera and two concerts. And one of these concerts was at a concert venue called the, I'm going to do a terrible job with this name, but I think it's Musikverein, I suppose. Anyway, it is one of the more legendary concert halls in the center of Vienna. And when I got in there, we were there to hear Strauss, and that's a pretty good place to be listening to Strauss, played by, not by the Vienna Philharmonic, although this concert hall is their home concert hall. It was another orchestra that the name of which escapes me just at this moment, but there are a few unusual things about this concert hall. So firstly, if you go to the internet and you do an image search for Musik with a K, Verein, which I believe is V-E-R, maybe E-I-N, I think. I don't actually have it in front of me, and I don't want to go thumping away on my keyboard making all this noise for me to edit out later, so I'll leave that for you to look up. But if you look up images of the inside of this hall, it's not exactly what you would describe as acoustically, it doesn't look like it's going to sound great. It's basically a big shoebox with a lot of very, very exquisite gold figuring and detailing and decorative elements all around the walls and the ceiling. It looks like an art gallery. It looks really, really stunning. And you would not really think of it as being a place that sounds that good acoustically. Mm-hmm. But, Mike, I have to tell you, I have never, ever experienced anything like this hall when it comes to acoustics. It was absolutely divine. And it was so divine that I thought, like, this is, how am I discovering this? This is ridiculous. And I checked it up on Wikipedia, and sure enough, there's even a paragraph on the Wikipedia page for this hall that mentions that this is one of something like five or six concert halls in the world that have just kind of by total fluke, because these things were created before there was such a thing as acoustic science, by total fluke, has like some of the most outstanding, extraordinary acoustic properties. And people have theorized something about this sort of long shoebox shape and potentially something about all of the exquisite detailing and like lumpy surfaces all around it, basically, creates this sound which is just so buttery smooth. It's unbelievable. I was trying to sit there listening to the Strauss being played very, very dramatically by this Viennese orchestra, thinking, what is it? Is it a lack of reverb, or is it a particular kind of very, very nice reverb, or is it a fusion, or is it some kind? And I couldn't figure it out. But basically, the orchestra sounded like, kind of like if you imagine recording an orchestra and then mixing in a fully wet, very, very, very dense, very diffuse reverb at about maybe 60% wet dry mix.
Okay.
So everything sounded extremely lush and full. However, there was a very distinctive clarity where you could just pick out every single instrument of the orchestra. So it was like having this sort of glue, reverberative glue to the orchestra sound, together with the dry signal there, allowing you to really place in the stereo field every single instrument. And it was really, yeah, I had to, you might remember a few months ago we had Martin Stig Anderson on the show, and he's an acquaintance of mine, and I actually wrote to him while I was there. It's like, my God, this hall is just unbelievable. And he wrote back to say, yeah, I know, right? I've been there before. It's amazing.
Now, some questions at this juncture. One,
yeah,
where were you seated in the hall? And two, which Strauss piece were you listening to?
Right. Well, I'll start with the second one. The Strauss piece we were listening to was Don Juan.
Mm.
The answer to the first question, we were seated basically towards the back, quite close to the wall. So basically not really what you would consider to be optimal position for, you know, sitting in a concert hall. It was a totally packed out attendance, so we didn't really have much choice, but we were sort of, yeah, at the back on the side. And just, oh man, it's like I said, it is just like absolutely extraordinary how good it sounded.
So you were seated in a kind of unflattering position, and yet you felt like you had this transcendent listening experience.
Exactly. And, you know, I love a good reverb. The thing that really kind of struck me about, you know, the sort of reverb properties of this hall, normally when you think about using reverb to create a sense of lushness and a sense of sort of thick, dense atmosphere around a sound, the thing that we would immediately probably go to do is to pump up that decay length. So you have quite a long decay length, which sort of helps things sort of swirl around a bit and create this sort of bed of reverberation underneath everything else, giving this sense of kind of thickness, like a foggy thickness, right? What was so remarkable about this hall was that the actual decay length of the reverb, because if you know Don Juan, there are a few moments when there are like the whole orchestra just cuts. There are a few moments in it. And during those cuts, I was paying special attention to the length of that decay.
Were you calculating the RT60 during those pauses?
Exactly. And what was really shocking was that actually it was only really like about 2 or 3 seconds of decay on the sounds when the orchestra sort of cuts abruptly like that. So very, very relatively short decay length for a sound that was so thick and so lush. So from a sound engineer's point of view, it was incredibly educational and just really quite extraordinary. So on Wikipedia, they do list the five other halls in the world, I think 4 or 5 other halls in the world that have similarly kind of remarkable acoustic properties. Go and have a look. And if one of these halls is in your vicinity, I highly recommend going and listening to an orchestra play in there, because, well, not necessarily just an orchestra, but anyone play in there, because, again, just from a sound design, sound engineering perspective, just incredibly inspiring and very, very educational. It's like, yeah, I want to go back home and try to replicate something like that with any one of the far too many reverb plugins that I own.
I'm looking at a picture of the hall now, and for the benefit of our listeners who are not equipped with visual aids, I would say that the best way I would describe it is that the interior of the hall looks like what you would expect the exterior of the hall to look like. It's you almost feel like the structure is inside out because there's these ornate doorways and there's lots of sort of Baroque-ish filigree everywhere. I don't have the greatest perspective because I'm just looking at one image, but there, if the music turns out to be dull, which is not going to be the case with Strauss, but if you're listening to something that's sort of sedate and not engaging your interest, there's a lot just to visually feast upon.
Yeah, and another thing that was really nice was that they leave the lights on. They don't turn the lights down. And that's quite nice, actually. It gives a concert like this a much more sort of authentic feeling because, of course, for non-religious music played by orchestras in the Romantic period and before, orchestra concerts apparently were much more, I guess, less stiff affairs than they have become in our time. You know, when you think of an orchestral concert in our time, it's quite a formal, stiff kind of thing. But at least as far as I've read, you know, if you think about music in non-religious contexts played purely for entertainment, often it was a much more, shall we say, rustic atmosphere, and having the lights on for the duration of the, so that the lights don't fade down or anything, created this really nice sort of lack of tension, even though everybody, of course, was very, you know, well-behaved in the way that we are in this era. Just that being able to sit there and admire all of this incredible decorative gold elements all across the entire interior of the hall and being treated to this beautiful sound. And then, of course, this is before we even talk about the magnificence of Strauss as a musical piece anyway. It was quite a memorable experience, to say the least.
This is a bit sacrilegious, but I feel like it's a natural place to go, given the nature of our podcast. I wonder if anybody has done a convolution sample of the acoustic space, and if you can access it that way through Altiverb or one of the equivalent reverb plugins.
Yeah, I'm absolutely sure that somebody would have because, I mean, if it's mentioned on Wikipedia as this as being, you know, one of just a few extraordinarily divine environments for, you know, for acoustic quality, then I'm pretty sure somebody will have made an impulse response of it somewhere.
Well, the trick is that not every venue wants to be sampled in that way. There may be mistrust, but there also may be a desire not to have the unique sonic characteristics of a space that is essentially dependent on tourism for income.
Right.
Approximated in for anyone with $50 and a DAW. Both in the sense of, you know, you're creating competition for your unique asset, but also convolution is never going to give the full experience of being in a space. So there may be also a sense of not wanting to tarnish the reputation. So those factors always play in.
Yeah. And also I'm sure doing a big sign sweep from whatever they start when they do IR impulse responses, maybe it might like vibrate loose some of that beautiful gold figuring on the walls. We wouldn't want that.
I feel like if you don't know exactly why your space has desirable acoustic properties, you're also going to be very risk averse to doing anything that might disrupt the mojo that you don't fully understand.
Yeah. Anyway, highly, highly recommended. But Mike, now rumor has it that you're actually now on a totally new system.
I am. For about a decade, a little under, I had been using what is affectionately called the Trash Can Mac, which is the 2013 Mac Pro that had a cylindrical shape. And that machine was somewhat maligned because of design decisions. And it looked beautiful when you put it on your desk and plugged nothing into it. But as you turned it into a machine that had some utility and you added hard drives and lots of other appurtenances, it would become increasingly like a giant octopus of cables. So that served me well, and it didn't really owe me any favors by the end of its life. But I felt like it was time to move on. And the arrival of the two new high-end Macs on the scene gave me the opportunity I needed to move forward. So I went the route, well, for those of you who are not glued to Mac news the way I am, or Apple news, there are two basic new offerings as of last summer, and one was the Mac Studio and the other is the Mac Pro. And both of these machines were almost, I mean, they were substantially similar in terms of having the same processor. So in terms of raw computational ability, there was nothing to recommend one versus the other. The difference, the practical difference, is that the Mac Studio was didn't have internal slots, and the Mac Pro had a bunch of them. Mm. So the judgment call in deciding which of these two machines to pick is, to what extent do you care about having internal PCI slots? Mm. And I thought long and hard, and decided that actually, yes, I did want to have internal PCI slots and put all my hard drives on the inside of the machine and not deal with expansion chassis and externalities and all the complexities and potential failures that can come along with that route. And I think this perspective comes from having used the Trashcan Mac Pro and having been entirely dependent on external enclosures, which in my personal experience, failed often. So there was a lot of stress involved, yeah. So I decided to go the route that was a little more future-proof in that it allows your hard drives to be a little faster, but above all was simpler and had less complexity and fewer points of failure. So my methodology for configuration, and I recommend this to everyone, was to find out what Vince bought and essentially get the same exact configuration. Because Vince has such attention to detail when it comes to the technical components of a system that I guessed that whatever research I did was not going to exceed whatever research he did combined with the powerful contents of his mind. So I literally cloned his specs. I did go in a different direction in terms of hard drive configuration. He's all about RAIDs and I didn't want to bother. But in terms of the machine, our respective Mac Pros are essentially identical.
And what's the, are you all done now with like transitioning and reinstalling everything and getting all of your sound libraries migrated and all the, I don't know, like the paths all set up in Kontakt and Logic and everything like that?
Well, in answering that, let me draw from your own experience in moving, as you've moved several times in the last couple of years. As you know, when you move, you first thing you do is you set up the necessities. You get your furniture, you get whatever kind of electronics you have in your new place. You've got to set up a router, you've got your computers. And over time, you unpack the boxes and you place things where you want. And there's this sort of long tail where 6 months later, you're 80% unpacked. And then a year later, you're 90% unpacked. And it might actually be an asymptote. So I think moving to a new computer is very similar. I quickly got up and running with the most important aspects of my system. I got Logic running. I moved my instrument drives onto the new system. I revalidated all my plugins, which was a very painstaking and slow process, I want to say. Got the iLog pointed to the new machine, all of that. But I'm a far cry from having moved everything over. And partially, this is because I decided instead of doing a brain transplant where you tell your new computer, just please, you tell your old computer, clone yourself and set up the system drive of the new computer to match the old computer, I just started to start fresh.
Right.
So I figured there was a lot of, you know, a decade's worth of digital cruft that had accumulated that I didn't want to bring over to my beautiful and expensive new system.
Yeah, probably. It's a healthy thing every now and then to do that, I think.
Well, this is actually, I was going to spin a low-grade philosophical point off of this because
okay,
I did this mostly.
I love this.
It's like epiphenomenal philosophy. It's not like a topic in its own right, but it's an accidental rebound off of another topic. So I did this mostly for practical reasons, and I was worried about digital detritus that I didn't need, all those files that uninstallers did not successfully uninstall, and so on. But what I found was, in starting from scratch, it prompted me to reevaluate just about every aspect of my system, all my presets, which plugins I actually wanted, which plugins I wanted in my lists of my plugin folders that Logic allows you to create. And I had the occasion to ask myself, do I really ever use this reverb? And do I want it there in a big menu that is supposed to be my frequent flyer plugins? And what I found as a side effect of all of this is I really streamlined what I'll call the sort of the quick access menus, the things that are supposed to be your most frequently accessed tools. And I streamlined them by the most natural way of just not installing or not including every single plugin that I had. And I'm really liking the result. I have a system that's simpler, has fewer options, and the options that are presented to me are the things that I actually use more often. So I would have never have done this on my old system. Like it's, tell me if you agree, but I think it's much harder to deinstall something or to move something out of your easy access folder than it is to decide not to include it again. I think the psychological barriers are lower, and you don't find yourself saying, well, how do I know I'm never going to use this reverb? It's, you know, when you have to spend effort to include something, you are less likely to do so unless you really feel like it warrants the effort.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And unfortunately, you know, we are really, really, really spoilt for choice. In fact, so much so that the choice of tools really puts us into this kind of terrible, what do they call it, paralysis from analysis situation, where you just sort of sit there frozen trying to figure out whether you should be choosing Valhalla Vintage Verb versus, you know, I don't know, Seventh Heaven or whatever. you'll note that I specifically chose two reverbs that I know you own.
I appreciate there, that. Yes, thank you.
Anyway, and I think, unfortunately, you know, because of this choice and the fact that plugins, for the most part, if you're a professional game audio musician, for the most part, plugins are not that expensive, with the exception of a few. And so, you know, it's a lot of fun, and yeah, playing around with different kinds of tools and hearing how things are different, and then sort of justifying it with this idea that, well, it's good to have options. You know, it's good to have options. And therefore, that's where it leads into what I think you're saying there, Mike, as well, that like, well, I don't want, just because I don't use Valhalla Room so much anymore, you know, it doesn't mean that I should delete it, because like, it's good to have options, isn't it? You know, maybe there will be one day when it's like, oh, I really need that sound that every player and every other game audio professional knows only comes from Valhalla Room. And if I don't have it, everybody's going to be just laughing at me, saying, "Ah, oh, the guy, he should have used Valhalla Room, but he didn't. He used Seventh Heaven here. I can hear it. I can hear the difference." I'm being very, very sarcastic, of course, but yeah, I don't know. I have a love-hate relationship with my own obsession with accumulating plugins. Hate, because yep, there are quite a few moments when I just sit there looking at this list thinking, I don't know, I guess this one will be all right. Doesn't quite sound right. Well, maybe I made the wrong choice and I should be using that one, which is, of course, totally wrong. But then on the other side of it as well, you know, we've got to have some fun, right?
The novelty of something new is a treat. I think that there's a real danger in that, prescriptively, if you're going to buy another, let's say, reverb, that's not wildly and dramatically different from the reverbs you have. In addition to the cost of purchasing the plugin, you have to ask yourself, what is the time cost of bifurcating my decision tree? Where instead of just grabbing for Valhalla, now I'm going to stop and say, well, do I want the Valhalla sound or do I want the Liquid Sonic sound?
Right.
That's a real time cost. I have sometimes had to metaphorically slap myself when I was spending too much time on that completely unnecessary decision.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the same too. And I think I found one sort of a solution to this for myself, at least. And that is when I'm doing a project in the so-called pre-production phase, when I'm just fiddling around with ideas and working out what I want to do with it from an artistic point of view, I often find it very, very helpful to create a template for that project, because I don't work from a sort of a general template. All of my DAWs start up completely blank. But creating a template for the project, which has one reverb and it has one delay on an aux send, or like one chorus, or like just sort of choosing specific tools. And that even goes to the point of saying one soft synth, like just going to choose this one for this project, and then trying to have a little bit of fun with working with those limitations, has been a nice compromise between enjoying the wonderful different products that are available out there, but at the same time, not getting yourself so locked down into thinking about process and tool choice and all of these things that, as you say, can kind of lock you up and really hinder your efficiency.
I completely agree on that approach. I have attempted to set up a general template, and I realized it was foolish because there's no such thing as a general project. There's only a specific project. Mm. So in trying to anticipate every possible need for every possible genre, I found that my template was just essentially becoming my entire collection.
Right.
So now I build a new template for each project, just like you were saying, and I do try to commit myself to a set of tools. Unless one cue is stylistically very different from another, in which case I permit myself to branch out a bit. But I think you're right. It's great just to say, let's turn on the reverb and not worry about what it is, because you made a technical and artistic decision at the outset of the project to go with a particular route.
Yeah, and it works really well with synths as well. You know, if you are, if you're like me and you love synths, synthesizers of all shapes and sizes and synthesis paradigms and all of this, it's an interesting approach to limit yourself to just one, as in, you, of course, you have multiple instances of it, but just one. It does create a certain aesthetic compass, I suppose, through all of the things that you do for the project. It will be sort of like a consistent sound, so to speak, just simply because you're working with the confines of this one particular synth. Of course, if you're choosing synths, if you have ones that are known for their extreme versatility, like, for example, UVI Falcon or Phase Plant or Pigments, Arturia Pigments or Yuhi Zebra or Dune or, yeah, any one of these big go anywhere, do anything kinds of four-wheel drive synthesizers, then maybe this isn't so effective because they can kind of sound like so many different sorts of things. But if you're using something that is much more stylized or something that has a particular sound or an emulation of hardware, then it can be a nice way to get some consistency into your sound when you're working with synthesizers.
I agree, but for a different reason. In my case, I typically will use synths on film projects and not game projects. But when I'm doing that, my needs are so much less sophisticated than yours, because I'll use them in a supplementary kind of way rather than as the backbone artistically of my palette. So when I need to incorporate electronics, I will say, okay, I need, you know, this kind of bass sound, I need this kind of drum sound, I need this kind of pad. And I'll set aside a few, because otherwise I would be lost searching through so many options and in some cases not really having the discrimination to be able to pick one over the other because they're so close to each other. So it's from having much simpler needs that I have to commit myself to a palette and come to the same conclusion that you are.
On that point, actually, when you are at the start of a project, let's say it's for a game and you've received, you know, you've got the brief, the client says, we trust you, Mike, we know that you'll deliver something incredible, so you just go ahead and do what you think is right. Here's a whole folder of concept art and a GDD for you to read and digest and to think about, and come back to us next week with some ideas of what you think might be good. If you've got this kind of, let's say, fairly ideal setup, good fun, and that the project has a very, very specific look, and the gameplay is very, very clear and well-defined, but the client has not said to you anything about what kind of music, and they just purely want to leave it up to you. How much does genre come into the play here as a factor that you'll want to sit down and think about in your case?
Now, I hate to answer a question with a question, but what do you mean by genre? Or can you give some examples of the granularity that you're referring to when you're saying genre?
Yeah. So basically musical genre. So for example, could it be orchestral? And inside orchestral, there'll be, you know, a few different directions that you can go that could all be considered orchestral. But outside of that as well, maybe it would be electronic. And then of course, inside electronic, you've got loads of different subgenres of electronic music that potentially you could go. Or it could be something that you would record or have recorded for you with acoustic instruments like guitars or hand percussion or things like that, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I mean by genre.
Right. I would say that I typically don't think of working within a specific genre. I'll put an asterisk, and I'll get back to what the asterisk signifies a little bit. But I think of genres as colors on a palette, musical resources from which one can draw. What I really do is I start with the project, whether it's a game or a film, and I say, you know, what's the sensibility of the project? What's the mood? What's the level of realism? What's the emotional tone? Where's the setting? And I try to come up with it from that. An instrumental palette, I'm going to invent a term, but kind of an emotional palette. You know, what's the mood that we're trying to get at? Games may be more visceral. They may be more adrenalized. Films may be more dramatic. They may be more mature in tone, though the reverse could be true in both of those media. And so I'll start with that. I might even come to instrumentation before I reach genre. You know, I might say this needs an organic orchestral sound without saying, well, I feel like this should have a 1750 to 1820 kind of, you know, literal classical sound or a neoclassical sound for the 20th century or something. And having picked a kind of instrumentation palette, I may then draw from different genres and blend and mix them up depending on what kind of mood or what kind of connotations that I might want to give, if that makes sense. Like to pick a project that you and I both collaborated on, Ghost Attackers VR, which for the benefit of our audience was a kind of a collaborative VR shooter in a more or less friendly haunted mansion kind of environment. You know, it was scary, but it was scary in a Disney kind of way and not in like a Saw kind of way, right? Does that sound like a fair characterization of the project?
Yeah, it was basically Luigi's Mansion, sort of like a Luigi's Mansion ripoff, I guess, basically. I can say this
homage.
Now. Homage, okay, very good. Because this is like 8 years ago, I think, and it was for a client in Japan for an LBE project, a location-based, basically a VR arcade game way back. But a fun project. It sounded great.
Well, thank you for my part in that, which was obviously also the work of your sound design. So for that project, it was scary, but it was scary in a over-the-top kind of way. It was essentially an arcade game, not a sustained experience with a backstory and world and characters. There wasn't a lot of gravita. It was a lot of immediate gratification, right? It was a thrill a minute and a lot of laugh screaming. And that lent itself to a kind of over-the-top romantic approach with a big orchestra sound. It wasn't an intimate chamber orchestra sound. It was like, you know, throw the whole, the ensemble from your friend Strauss, fly them out from that Vienna concert hall and bring them here. And it needed a kind of lightheartedness on top of those massive orchestral forces. At the same time, there are certain traditions in spooky music and or at least in music that has come to be heard of as spooky. So for the main theme, we had a theremin, right? Some whistling. So things that are kind of on the comedic side of mysterious. So you can see I assembled this instrumentation concept almost before I really thought about the specific genre that I was drawing from. In the end, I think we could point to certain genres, and there were certain role models and reference tracks that we all referred to, but I really started with the mood of that game and also thinking what the player experience was going to be like playing that. And from there, I then saw all the genres in the world as kind of like the items at the buffet, and you can just take what you need. That may have been way too long an answer for a fairly simple question, but that's where I went.
You know what? I'm very envious of you. And this has been something that I've been struggling, particularly with a project that we're doing at Moon Mode, my company Moon Mode, right now. I'm very envious of you because as a master of orchestral instrumentation that you are, that, you know, the orchestra is extremely flexible in terms of the what you can achieve in texture before you've even talked about genre. You know, genre is less important when the instrument that you're dealing with, the orchestra, can on its own create so many different kinds of textures. And so those emotional needs that the game has, or that any project has that you work on, a lot of them can be served so well by orchestral instrumentation, especially orchestral instrumentation on your level, where you have that experience and that ability to really sculpt different kinds of emotional objectives out of the same group of instruments, or, like, you know, permutations of those instruments. And that's really, really cool. I have been having a sort of a pretty intense identity crisis, I suppose, with this last project. My problem is I love electronic music. That's my passion. I love synths. And one thing that's very, very interesting about synthesizers in music, especially when you look at the various different genres of electronic music and dance music and electronica and all of this, one thing that's very interesting is you get kind of like, let's call it the Fender Stratocaster phenomenon, shall we?
Please elaborate.
Actually, you know what? I think we can group pretty much all of Leo Fender's early instruments, like the Telecaster, the Stratocaster, and of course the precision bass and the jazz bass. You know, these instruments were coming around at a time when these new genres of rock and roll music were coming together so rapidly and so quickly that now, fast forward to today, and the Fender Strat and the Telecaster and all of these very, very seminal early instruments are kind of like templates for this sound. You know, if you want rock and roll, sure, there are many, many other options to go to, but these instruments will get you that sound immediately because it is like the iconic sound of a genre. And in music with synthesizers, we see a similar kind of phenomenon where certain kinds of sounds, certain synthesizers will immediately give you the feeling of certain genres. You know, for example, yeah, if you want early 80s pop music, then of course you need a Yamaha DX7 and a, you know, right, like a Lindrum, you know. And if you want like, I don't know, if you want like acid techno, then of course you need a TR-909 and a TB-303. And, you know, if you want like, let's say, late 90s jungle, then of course you need the Amen Break and you need like a Akai S950, you know, with some Korg M1 pads sampled badly, and there you go, you've got 90s jungle. You know, it's so prescriptive, that the instrument and the sound, that makes things very, very easy but also very, very difficult at the same time. And what I mean by that is that as somebody who, like, I live and breathe this kind of electronic music. It's my passion. I love it, all of it. What it means is that when I sit down in that same position that I just presented to you, and I've got a project in front of me, and I'm thinking, right, they've given me free rein. I know my emotional objectives. I know what I have to do from a music spec point of view. The first thing that I think about is genre. And this is really, really painful because I've had experiences before on different projects where I've noticed my tendency to think about genre first, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, maybe I should go for, like, you know, sort of like an industrial hard techno sound for this, or like, maybe this is a good one for some liquid drum and bass, or like, actually, you know what, this needs acid techno, or whatever, right? I've noticed this tendency, and I've been in projects before where I've specifically, in this early pre-production phase, thought, right, I don't want to get into that trap, so what I'm going to do is intentionally not think about genre, and I'm just going to just go for it. Just write something. Don't think about, you know, am I trying to get this sound or that sound? Just go for it and see what happens. And if anything, it'll sound like me, right? You know, it doesn't matter what genre it is if it sounds like me. And with electronic music, I've consistently found that in those situations, I get better responses from the development team or clients that I'm working with when it is an electronic music that has a very clearly defined genre. It's not so sort of experimental and weird and out there. It's just like, oh, I see. Yeah, you got some dubstep here for this part. That's great. So I don't know. Is this a phenomenon with electronic music where we are much more likely to rely on these categories of sounds which form these genres to latch onto, simply because electronic music is so kind of boundaryless, it can sound like anything? Or is it my problem that I think too much about genre and I don't have enough of an identity as a musician myself to say, no, you know what, instead of it sounding like jungle or techno or any of those, I want it to sound like Alex May. So this has been a big identity crisis, and just before I pass it over to the mic over to you for some much needed counselling, as a specific example of where this has bitten me in the butt on this project that we're doing, it's got a rather nostalgic look to it. It sort of looks like a photo from the 70s, basically. And on the outset of doing this, I was thinking, right, what kind of music shall I do for this? And this game needs to have an element of excitement, but it also needs to have a slight sort of sadness-tinged element of nostalgia and self-reflection and things like that wrapped up in the same game. So I'm thinking, immediately my mind goes to genre, thinking, okay, what genre do I know can cover both of these things and that would be fun to do? The game is also, the art style, as well as looking nostalgic, it has a rather cute, endearing kind of feel to it. So I'm thinking, okay, in the end, I went with sort of like a late 70s radio orchestra, you know, kind of like if you know the Saturday Night Fever album.
Sure.
There's a song on there called Manhattan Skyline, which is like a late 70s, yeah, a studio orchestra kind of sound where you've got a drum kit, a bass, a guitar, and an orchestra.
Right.
Basically.
A lot of TV music fit that bill.
Yeah, exactly. And then for the entire process of doing this project, I've been kicking myself thinking, why did I make that decision based on genre? If I had just gone, because now that we're coming to the end of this project, I'm looking at the game, it's looking fantastic. I'm listening to the music and just feeling like I'm just shrugging my shoulders thinking like, why did I choose that? It sort of fits, but there's nothing appealing or interesting or unique or unusual or inspiring about this music choice and then the resultant sound that I achieved because of it. It's just sort of an obvious, boring choice. Yeah, I can get the nostalgia and I can get the sort of excitement from that, but also the melancholy moments as well can be served by this so-called genre. But it would have been a whole lot more fun and I probably would have come up with something much more creative and also memorable from a player's perspective if I had not thought about things in terms of genre and if I had just gone for it and say, well, I like this synth, I like that reverb, I like this delay effect, let's go, let's just make something and see what happens. I would have come up with something much more creative, I think, than what I did. So I'm envious of you, Mike, and I need counselling. Is this my problem or is it just a limitation or not limitation, like a idiosyncrasy of electronic music and synthesizers? Or help me understand myself, Mike.
Whew, there's a lot to unpack there, but I want to start by summarily rejecting the implied self-criticism of your own work, because based of my sampling of your work, everything you do is enjoyable in some way. it sounds like you are criticizing yourself for lack of novelty or imagination, that the genre itself is not an inspired choice, and therefore that detracts from the score. And I want to point out that working in a familiar genre is not in and itself a bad thing, if that's what the project needs. So there's no reason to, I mean, on a professional level of self-improvement, yes, you can always say, could I have done something more exciting here? Could I have done something more innovative? But at the end of the day, when people are listening to your music, no one's going to be like, another homage to 1970s TV orchestra style. For one thing, that's not actually a common thing after, you know, 1979, right? I mean, I can't remember a lot of games that have that approach. Maybe if there's like a very tongue-in-cheek kind of cop game, there might be some throwback to, you know, that kind of sound with the wah guitar and everything. But the example you've given of a genre that's not inspired kind of sounds inspired to me. So I have to add some caution to your self-criticism. But addressing the broader question here, I think that pop music tends to map to genres or to combinations of genres more so than orchestra music. And I think when it comes to pop music, we want to think of a genre as a reference point. And we might even move away from that reference point. We might say, I want you to imagine if the Glenn Miller Orchestra had only children's instruments to work with, right? So that's obviously moving away from the traditional big band sound, but it's rooted in a reference to a particular genre or a particular artist in this case. And I think that's natural when you're dealing with what I'll call, you know, kind of rhythm section, you know, pop music tradition. I think that's just the way that we think of music that way, that's in that meta category. Now, that doesn't mean, however, that all electronic music has to be genre-based. If I were to divide electronic music primitively into two groups, I would say kind of pop music, electronic music, and then electronic music where the use is more akin to an orchestra. So the difference might just be there's no drums. But for what it's worth, if we use that division, I think when the electronic music takes on a pop music character, then we will naturally start with genres as our building blocks.
Right.
And if it's more, I mean, I don't want to say like the Subotnik or those crazy experimental electronic musicians of the, you know, the 50s and 60s. But if you're going away from things with drums, I think there's a little more freedom, though there also may be more difficulty in finding what your palette is, because electronic music is the ultimate freedom of and confluence of too many possibilities, right? So, yeah, that's how I would think of it. Stuff with drums, I think we will be a little genre based, but there's a difference also. There's a distinction to be drawn. I'm getting really professorial here. I'm sorry. There's a distinction to be drawn between how we think about the music when we are coming up in the privacy of our heads with an approach for a project, and how we pitch the music to clients. And in the latter case, there is a real advantage to genre references, because clients may not have a musical education.
Right.
They may not know what they know, and they may need to hear something familiar in order to understand what it is that you're pitching.
Right.
So even if in the privacy of your head, you're concocting something really original that's very eclectic and it's a mixture of different things, it behooves you, it behooves us, to be able to articulate that idea with reference to existing genres of music or, if necessary, existing scores.
Right.
Just so the client isn't going to like assume that Homer Simpson look where each eyeball is going the other direction and there's total abject confusion. Even if you have to dumb down your concept, even if you're just expressing a little bit of your musical concept, it helps to refer to genres just to get your foot into the door and get started. And then once you start playing music, then, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. You don't have to worry about it anymore. They'll either dig it or they won't. So to refer to your original question, I think it's natural to think of genres when working with pop style music. I don't think it's to your detriment at all, except to the extent that it causes you frustration or makes you enjoy the process less, in which case you should definitely try new things. But there's the from what you described, there's nothing wrong with the approach you're taking.
Well, I feel better a little. I also think that electronic music really is a rather special presence in the realm of sort of musical choice that we have when we're mapping out an artistic specification for a game's music. Just as you said, being able to go to a client or a collaborator and saying, yeah, I mean, just like the Prodigy, you know, Big Beat, just like the Prodigy. Remember them from the 90s? Yeah, I know the Prodigy. Yeah, that'd be great. Just like that. Fantastic. Being able to say that and having these slices of style, when you think about the breadth that you go within the slice that is, say, Big Beat, it's quite narrow. It's quite prescriptive. You know, when you have it, when you say one of these electronic music genres, that sound is quite distinctive. The style of the percussion, which synthesizers you're using, what kind of way they've been programmed, the effects, the mix, you know, all of these things are very, very, they're quite tightly bound when you're using genre to describe electronic music. And that is, I think, an area where I think that definitely the orchestra just simply has an advantage because, yeah, you have the same instruments, but depending on the permutations and then depending how you write for them, you know, you can't specifically say that just this style of orchestral music. So only choose a clarinet, a flute, and a bassoon, and one cello, and call that genre X. If you imagine working like that, and then within genre X, your cello has to do this kind of rhythmic pattern, then you'll get specifically genre X. Now you can go to your client and say, how about genre X? And they'll know exactly what you mean, which instruments. Well, maybe they won't know specific instruments, but they'll know that there's a high likelihood they may know that sound. And that's kind of what it feels like working with electronic music sometimes. I'd love to be able to just do anything, just go for it, you know, make it bonkers, crazy stuff nobody's ever heard before. But the reality is that with electronic music, and again, coming back to what you said there, where being able to go to a client and say this style of music, when you do go way out there, you lose that benefit of having something for the listener to easily latch onto, whether that be the client or a player who's playing. It's like, oh, cool, I love this techno soundtrack, rather than, I don't really know what the music is doing in this game, but yeah, all right, I guess it makes me feel okay, but I don't really get it. You lose out on an advantage for the player to say, man, what a banger, love that techno song for this boss battle or whatever. Anyway, when you said that the two different categories of electronica music where you divided up into basically percussion forward, percussion heavy styles and not, one absolutely incredible artist composer that everybody should check out is Wendy Carlos. And unfortunately, most of Wendy Carlos's portfolio and the stuff that she has done is not available on Spotify or Apple Music.
Interesting.
So you actually have to go and listen to, I think she did Clockwork Orange and she did Tron.
Well, Tron, famously, yeah.
Yeah, the original Tron soundtrack. You'd actually have to find the soundtracks. So, yeah, a bit of Wikipedia research and then looking up individual actual soundtracks from the movies might be a better way to experience. But her work is absolutely incredible in terms of a very interesting, different, antiquated direction to take synthesizers, where she literally is using synthesizers like an orchestra, as opposed to how somebody like me is more likely to use synthesizers, which is basically to evoke a genre, which circles back to the beginning of this discussion, which we shall not do. So anyway, speaking of listening to Wendy Carlos, which I may or may not have been doing recently, let's finish up the show with our usual conspicuous consumption segment, which is where we go around the metaphorical table here and find out what kinds of games or media, books, literature, art galleries, concerts, music, fine dining, wines, I don't know, you name it, that we have been conspicuously consuming. So,
I don't think we've ever talked about food yet, but there's no reason we shouldn't.
No, that's right. So anyway, Mike, what have you been conspicuously consuming over these past weeks?
Oh, so much, but I feel like the most recent and most relevant thing is my having purchased a MetaQuest 3 and plunging into the VR world firsthand.
All right.
I've had a fairly, I've been having the newbie experience, so it's broad and shallow. I've been trying a little bit of this and that. But what I found is that I'm sort of embarrassingly susceptible to the basic premise of VR. Like when I put on the helmet and I'm standing on some, you know, a fairly tacky vista with a city in the distance and inexplicably a windmill, and I'm on my private porch and there's a fire burning somewhere, and being able to sort of pretend walk around and feel like you're in a different place, it's, I mean, this may be the novelty speaking, but it's so cool. Just the basic idea of pretending to be somewhere and fooling your perceptual system into thinking you are in another space. It's so much fun. I don't know if this is going to burn out in a week, but right now I'm enjoying that new flush of fundamentally different experience. And I'm enjoying all the dumb demos and all the sort of shallow mini games, and it's a blast. I'm a little disappointed with how non-prominent audio seems to be, at least in the experiences I've had so far. But I haven't really tried any serious games yet, including the ones I've scored myself. So I'm just scratching the surface of the experience so far. But so far, so good. Weirdly fun. How about yourself?
Well, you need to try Down the Rabbit Hole and Space Folk City. Because obviously Down the Rabbit Hole is the game that we worked on, and Space Folk City is the game that Vince and I worked on. Yeah, in terms of impressive audio specification, there you go. That's two fine pieces of software right there. Anyway, that's really cool. Yeah, I hope it doesn't wear off. For some people, it never wears off. You know, this idea of VR, the immersive properties of those experiences, especially when they're done well, for some people it never gets old.
The aspect that I do hope wears off is the mild motion sickness that I'm still getting. It's not too bad, but I experimentally, when I was in, I forget what it's called, like World Horizons or whatever, the kind of included multi-environment package where you can go into different shared and individual spaces, when you turn left or right, or where you rotate your view, it kind of pops from A to B. It doesn't rotate smoothly like you'd expect in like a first person traditional video game. So I twiddled with the settings. I'm like, no, I don't want to just like jump 45 degrees every time I hit left or right. I want it to just smoothly rotate like we'd expect. And the second I did that, I saw why they had made that default choice the way they had, because I was like sick to my stomach instantly. So
yeah,
I'm definitely getting my sea legs in terms of the perceptual effects. But other than that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a whole different discussion, which we won't go into today. But also, that is one of the very, very, I guess, frustrating aspects of VR game design and VR experience design for somebody like myself who's been doing this for 9 years, I think now. The idea that the consumer should have to get used to it, it's basically bad design. You know, if it's bad design, there's no reason that the consumer should have to get used to that, or, you know, you have to get your air quotes VR legs. That's ridiculous. This is very much, I suppose, a policy of my company, that if it makes you uncomfortable, that's just bad design. It's not your fault that you feel uncomfortable. It's our fault that the experience isn't designed better for you.
In defense of the industry, if I remember correctly, and you may have a better recollection than I do, it took, you know, when we moved to the modern 3D paradigm of just regular video games, and they were figuring out how to move the camera, there was a period where you could get motion sick just from like an N64 or, you know, like a PlayStation 2. Just like they hadn't figured out the conventions of perspective that wouldn't make us nauseous. And I think that that knowledge base was developed over time. So potentially VR is in a similar state where they're really, you know, still trying to figure out some aspects of where human beings are sensitive in terms of perceptual experience.
No, actually, a lot of that has been codified already. But the thing is that the best practices that we know now for VR experience design that will not make you feel sick are extremely limiting in terms of what you can actually do. So basically, developers, now we have two choices. Either you do your best to work within those very, very strict limitations of what is comfortable in VR, or you go the other direction and you sort of skirt along things that you know are going to make a player feel bad, but from an artistic, from a game design and from an experience point of view, you know, you need to be risking that in order to achieve the artistic objective that you have in mind. So to answer your question, a lot of those things are already codified and we do know how to make an experience that would be very, very comfortable. However, that the code for doing that is just very, very, very limiting. And that, of course, restricts what people can do from an artistic point of view, which, of course, is frustrating. So, yeah, it's a discussion, Mike.
That's a show in its own right, yeah.
Yeah, indeed. As for myself, I've actually, I think last episode I just finished playing Starfield. I started playing Everspace 2, which is an open world RPG / space combat game, and really, really enjoyed the game itself, but really enjoyed the artistic aspect of the game. It looks absolutely beautiful, and as a piece of game design, it's exceptionally well created. Highly recommended if you're into that kind of thing, but I realized I'm kind of not into that kind of thing. I think if it's a space game, I really like it to be more like a simulator. And so I've actually gone back to playing Elite Dangerous again.
I was about to say what you described sounded a little bit like Elite, but clearly not enough like Elite to keep your interest.
No, exactly. Yeah, I've gone back to Elite again, and I love it. It's fantastic. And I realized that in the time since Elite's been out, because I think it's, what are we at, 5-6 years or something like that? It's been quite a long time that Elite Dangerous has been out. I realized that the genre of space game has actually shifted somewhat. Now people are a lot more demanding, probably no thanks to No Man's Sky and Star Citizen, people are a lot more demanding with what they want out of a space game. And so a game like Elite Dangerous, where it is purely a simulator for flying spaceships, there just isn't really anything else like it out there right now in terms of new games. All the other space games are trying to do everything, you know, trying to do so much more all in the one game experience. Whereas Elite Dangerous is still rather centralized on that space simulator or spaceship simulator aspect. So, yeah, that's what I've been not so conspicuously consuming.
As always, it's a fruitful time for the game player because, much like somebody trying to create a non-genre defined electronic music score, we are drowning in options.
Yes. Just before we finish up, Mike, on your new machine, what's in your reverb folder? Just run down the list quickly. Which ones did you keep in there?
Right. I'm a little afraid to look because I'm using Logic to record my end of this podcast and I don't want to anger it. But from memory, Spaces 2 is my go-to for convolution. Love it. I do have Seventh Heaven as it's not really an algorithmic reverb. It's actually a convolution of an algorithmic reverb. So it kind of straddles those two worlds. I have Valhalla Plate, though I'm using it less. And also a plugin that I know you like is Tai Chi Light, which is, nice. I guess, the only true algorithmic reverb in my frequent flyer folder.
Oh, Valhalla Plate is algorithmic as well.
Oh, that's right. You're right. So there's two.
Yeah. Okay, so Valhalla Room, Vintage Verb, they didn't make the cut.
Not yet. I haven't. I have used. I've used both in the past, but I'm kind of bringing them into the frequent flyer folder on an as-needed basis. So that,
I see.
You know, they're all, obviously they're accessible in the exhaustive list of plugins and Logic, but in that folder the quick access folder, Those are the ones that I have right now.
Got it. Excellent. All right. Well, on that bright and cheery note, let's wrap it up. So this has been episode 253 of the Game Audio Hour. And if you like what you heard today, please feel free to subscribe to us on your, what does Vince always say? Podcast purveyor of choice, I believe is the line. You can also go to gameaudiohour.com, which is a nice link tree page that gives you direction to our Twitter/X, as well as links to various different podcast purveyors where you can listen to previous episodes if you wish. And then Vince usually says, so why don't you go and do that while I... I wasn't ready for this. Why don't you go and do that while Mike, there you go. I threw it over to you.
Oh, gets ready to install new NVMe drives on my new machine that will hopefully work better than their predecessors.
Brilliant. There you go. And I'm going to go listen to Tai Chi Light and see if I can replicate the sound of that hall in Austria.